WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Let's get back to filmmaker Robert Wydy. We're talking about his new documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, which runs this month on HBO. You also say in this film that apart from his language, that it was his attacks of the church that got him in equal amounts of trouble. What did he not like about the church?
Well, the point is made in our film that there were a number of other comedians working at the time who were working in far more scatological terms than Lenny, but it tended to be more of the nudge-nudge kind of humor, two guys walk into a bar or farmer's daughter type material. And nobody bothered them because they weren't stepping on anyone's toes. Lenny upset a few people. What's interesting about the religion thing, and I should say this, that when he was busted in Chicago after his performance one night, a cop came into the club and talked to the owner and said, if you let him on stage tonight, mock my Pope the way he did last night, we're going to clip him, we're going to clip you and everyone in the joint. And he was a good, honest cop. He was true to his word. The next night, Lenny went on stage, talked about the Pope, and he was arrested. And I'll also add this, just because it's sort of interesting anecdotally, that during his trial, coincidentally, Ash Wednesday happened to fall on one of the days of his trial, and Lenny was in court, and in walked the judge with a spot of ash on his forehead. The DA had a spot of ash on his forehead. The bailiff had ash on his forehead. And then the jurors all walked in with ash on their forehead. So this was the fair trial that he got in Chicago. But, you know, he really had nothing against God. He had nothing against people who believed in God. What he spoke out against was the hypocritical things that many people do in the name of God. He really had no problem with the idea of religion. But he was asking serious questions that were on his mind. And I'll give you an example.
Go ahead.
There's a routine which is excerpted in my documentary where he fantasizes about Christ and Moses coming back down to earth. And they decide they're going to take in, the sermon at the St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. So they're standing in back of the church, and Cardinal Spellman is talking about love and peace and forgiveness. And Lenny says that Christ is confused because their route took them through Spanish Harlem. And Christ is wondering why 40 Puerto Ricans are living in one room when a square foot on that stained glass window is worth $10,000. So by today's standards, that's a fairly innocuous sort of routine. I mean, you could do that on network television now, and you might get a couple of letters, but that would be it. But what's interesting, to make this point further, is that a couple of years later, Lenny would refer back to that bit, and he'd say, you know, I used to do this routine about Christ and Moses, and he'd recount the bit. And then he'd say, you know, but then I gave it some thought, and if the purpose of the church is to teach, well, you have to bring people in to teach them. You have to bring your flock in. And he says, if I'm a raggedy-ass guy living in a raggedy-ass house in a raggedy-ass part of town, why would I want to go to a raggedy-ass church? So he came to that conclusion. He realized that the splendor and the majesty of the church was to provide an attractive environment to bring people in. And once he came to that conclusion, he never went back and did the old bit. So this is hardly a rebel who's out to, you know, overthrow organized religion or overthrow the government. This was a guy who just had questions on his mind, was asking them on stage and trying to keep it funny.
What point in his career did Lenny Bruce turn some of his attention to more political issues? And I'm thinking of things like the Vietnam War, civil rights.
Yeah, that would be, early, mid-60s. He wasn't so much political by nature. Eventually, he started to do political material, and he did talk about Vietnam and what he thought we were doing there. And he did talk about political leaders, be it Eisenhower, Nixon, even Kennedy and LBJ. He was more socially oriented, talking about relationships and that sort of thing. But again, you know, it really was whatever was on his mind that day he would talk about. And if there was some big political, you know, event in the news, he'd get up and talk about it. But basically, you know, his social and political awareness really bloomed, I'd say, around 1959 and continued, you know, through to the end.
We actually have a clip from a performance at Berkeley. This is, I believe, 1964, where he's talking about LBJ. Mm-hmm. Let's listen.
Lyndon Johnson, They didn't let him talk for the first 6 months. It took him 6 months to learn how to say Negro. Negro. All right. Okay, let's hear it one more time, Linda, now. Okay. Let him pose again, okay. Okay. Negro. Oh. Now, can you say, look, is it say it quick, Negro. Okay. Nigger, oh, Negro. I can't help it, I can't say it, that's all. I can't say Negro, I'm pissing in bed and everything is stuttering. I can't, what the hell, Negro. Let me show my scar. No. Just say it, and that's it. He's completely confused. Well, there really, that family is so, it's really, you know, there's a certain kind of non-Jewish look that they could pass any test. They are the biggest non-Jews in the world. No question, they walk right through the line, bap, bap.
And that's Lenny Bruce in Berkeley back in 1964. How do you think Lenny Bruce's being Jewish played into his humor? I mean, there's a whole tradition there, but how did he do it?
Well, I mean, you know, out of that Jewish tradition of making humor out of pain in life, I guess that would be the most obvious example. His mother, in some ways, was a very typical Jewish mother. In some ways, I guess she was the antithesis of a Jewish mother. But he certainly had Judaism instilled in him culturally, if not, you know, in an observant form. He used to do bits about, you know, he felt that he was just on kind of the tail end of anti-Semitism, that he paid, you know, a certain percentage of those dues. But he talked about the different phases of being Jewish, and he talked about how you go through that defensive period where somebody says to you, what time is it? And you say, yeah, I'm Jewish, so what? and he talked about very Jewish notions. I think his whole way of working was somewhat Talmudic, in that some people have said what he really was a funny rabbi. Huh. And of course, Jews always question. What's the old joke? You put two Jews together, you're going to get three opinions. And so Lenny was always just dissecting things and asking questions. And what he sort of ran up against was the mentality that you are not to question, which is, you know, more of the Catholic sort of thinking, which I don't say pejoratively, but that was sort of the conflict, was here was a guy on stage questioning everything, and he was told not to question, and I think that was the big conflict.
More about Lenny Bruce after this break. My guest is documentary filmmaker Robert Wydy. This is Fresh Air. Back with filmmaker Robert Wydy, his documentary, Swear to Tell the Truth, is about the life and comedy of Lenny Bruce. How many times did he get arrested?
My best count is 12, about a dozen times. There's actually, that doesn't count, an early arrest for impersonating a priest back in Miami. He was soliciting donations for some bogus charity that he put together. That was a whole other thing. But the bus started in 1961. The last big one was in New York in 64. And from 61 to 64, between the obscenity bus and the drug bus, there were about a dozen.
And did he ever spend time in jail? Did he ever have to pay a fine?
Well, he had to pay a lot of lawyer's fees, which, you know, most people can tell you is, you know, it's about six of one, half dozen of the other. No, he never did time, although there were periods of time that he'd be put in holding cells where he'd be arrested, he'd be brought to, headquarters, as they used to say in 40s movies, and he'd be held in, a cell overnight. That happened in New York after the arrest at the Cafe Agogo. He was brought downtown and put in a cell until the next morning.
He used a lot of the arrest material in his act at times. Mm. Even later on, he read from all sorts of police descriptions of what happened, from court transcripts as well. Did he embrace this idea of being arrested? Was that sort of part of what he wanted to do anyway?
No. It was a pain in the neck for him, and it was breaking him financially. I mean, at his peak, he was making a pretty solid six figures a year. And what happened once the arrests really started to escalate, and it really did start to snowball to Kafkaesque proportions, he couldn't get work. He couldn't get work because what they would do is they would also arrest the club owner, or they would take away their liquor license or shut them down. So club owners weren't going to take the risk of hiring him. So work dried up. He wasn't making any money. What money he did make was going to his lawyers. And these were just ridiculous cases where he had to fly all over the country and defend himself. He would have, you know, two or three court cases going on at a time. So no, he did not enjoy it. I think after the first obscenity arrest in San Francisco, he was acquitted on that charge. And at that point, I think he probably felt, okay, I'm cool. You know, mm-hmm. I've been acquitted in San Francisco. That sort of sets a precedent under equal protection. You know, I should be safe anywhere in the country. And soon after, he was arrested in Los Angeles in 1962 for saying the word schmuck on stage, which really, you know, gives you an idea of how silly this became. And he was acquitted in Los Angeles, but then he was arrested in Chicago. And he was found guilty in Chicago, and that was sort of the turning point. Then it really got ugly. And then the New York arrest was, the New York conviction was really the final nail in his professional coffin. It was very sad.
It is sad, though, to see Lenny Bruce's decline, and you begin to see the humor turn to rage, turn to a guy feeling sorry for himself, and it's and you see it in his face. It's a sad commentary.
Yeah, it takes a physical toll. And again, I'm the first one to say that there are two things going on at the same time. There was this really needless legal harassment he was going through. You know, cops showing up at his house, and Lenny saying, "Can I see your search warrant?" And the cops bringing out a gun and saying, "Here's my search warrant." And that kind of nonsense. A lot of busts that were clearly setups. A lot of the drug busts. I certainly have evidence to indicate that, you know, Lenny was set up on a lot of these. So there was legal harassment. They really wanted to shut this guy up. And at the same time, Lenny did have this Achilles heel of his drug use, and that took its toll too. I think the two were somewhat related. I think as not to justify it, but I think as the harassment escalated, the drug use escalated as well. I think he was trying to find a way to tune it all out. But yeah, it all did take a toll. And again, his finances just went down the tubes, and the money went to the lawyers, and he couldn't work. And it took a very definite toll, finally ending with his death at the age of 40 in 1966 from a drug overdose.
That's right, he died of a drug overdose. Who found him?
A buddy of his, who's become a friend of mine, a dear guy who lives in Northern California, named John Judnick. And John initially came to the house to work as Lenny's handyman and also a sound technician, and recorded a lot of his gigs. And he lived at the house and came home and was calling, Lenny, it's John. Couldn't find him, walked around the house and then found him lying on the floor in the bathroom.
When the police came to the house, they actually posed his body. They pulled his pants down.
Yeah. You want to talk about obscene, I'll give you the
really?
Ultimate obscenity. Because when John found him, he was, you know, Lenny had fallen on the floor off of the toilet. But John, out of respect for Lenny, knowing that people ultimately were going to be showing up at the house, put Lenny's pants on him and, you know, buckled him up, called one of Lenny's attorneys, who then, I guess, called, I don't know if he called the cops or if he called the press, but eventually the cops and the press both showed up. And the cops were letting reporters and photographers in two by two, sort of like at a deli counter when you take the number and they call your number and you get to go in. So the photographers were going in two by two, but they couldn't get a good shot of Lenny at the angle he was in. So the police sort of posed him. They pulled him out of the bathroom so the photographers could get a better shot at him. And then they pulled his pants off. They removed his pants. And the photographs and the news footage you see of Lenny at the end, basically, you know, it was a photo op. It was the final photo op. And I think it was the cops' way of saying, look, this is what happens when you take us on.
When would you say Lenny Bruce reached his peak? At what point in his life, his career?
I would say his peak years were from 57 through maybe 61. I'd say the top of the mountain for him was his performance at Carnegie Hall in February of 61. And as your listeners will see if they watch the show, is this took place in the middle of a devastating blizzard in New York City where public transportation came to a halt, even, you know, personal transportation. There's no way to drive through the city. They were just snowed in. And Lenny played Carnegie Hall at midnight, a midnight show in this blizzard, and sold the place out. And that concert actually exists on CD, unabridged, and it's a wonderful, wonderful concert. And you're really hearing Lenny just, you know, swing with the best of them.
Robert Wydy's documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, airs this month on HBO.